This is Dave and Barry from ScreenGeeks.com. We are today here with the director of official direction, rejection. Sorry, I can't talk today. Please tell us yourself and your background in film and a little bit about this film, Official Rejection.
Sure. Well, I'm Paul Osborne. I'm the director, writer, as much as you have a writer on a documentary, producer, editor, and unfortunately the narrator of Official Rejection. And my background in film, God, I mean, I was born with a camera in my hand. I grew up here in Denver, and actually, Denver was my back lot growing up shooting.
Oh, cool.
I'm old. Shooting Super 8 movies.
Nice.
Westminster Mall and downtown and all kinds of crazy places. Actually, the room with us right now is Buck Perrigo.
Buck.
Buck is a buddy of mine. Actually, he was my usual victim. He was usually victim number one in every film. First guy gunned down. I think we tortured you in my garage.
Yeah, right? I got that.
Yeah, we tortured you. We threw him off buildings. You know, then I went to the film school at the University of Miami, which is a kind of a strange choice. But, you know, it was the 80s and Miami Vice was big, and Miami seemed like a smart move. Really wasn't. But anyway, so I went to the University of Miami, and then I worked in production in Miami for a couple years. Moved out to Los Angeles. I started cutting. All this time I'm writing screenplays, you know, and started getting my feet in the door in different venues as a screenwriter. Wrote and produced a film called 10 Till Noon, which came out 3 years ago, and now Official Rejection.
So here's a big question. Having seen the film, was it an idea to do a documentary from the start based on your experiences with trying to get through the festival circuit?
Actually, it was.
Well, okay.
The thing that started it all was we finished our film, and you've seen the movie. I mean, we talk about, you know, your high hopes for your film when you're done because it's your baby and you love it, and then you put it out in the world, no one cares. We started kind of getting an inkling that the festival circuit was not as advertised, that it was not this, you know, the myth that exists, the Kevin Smith myth, where you can kind of go out and make a little film with credit cards and go and sell your movie at Sundance and become, you know, it doesn't really happen anymore. It's all much more of a corporate and star-driven and, you know, it's been co-opted by big business and the major studios. It was very different. It was not as advertised. And I thought, well, this is going to be a train wreck. We don't know what we're doing. We'd better find something to kind of tell us how to do this. So I wanted to see if there was a movie on the subject, a documentary. I wanted to not just know the information, but I wanted to have the experience of what it was like. I thought, there's got to be a doc about this. I mean, this filmmakers go to festivals, and filmmakers make movies, and they have cameras, and how could this not have happened? It had. No one had covered this before. No one had made a film about film festivals. And I don't know if it's because it just didn't occur to anybody, or if
could they be scared of the political ramifications?
Oh, I was going to say, you know, that's the thing. Like the things I'm talking about, people who've been on the circuit, they all know this stuff, and they go, "Oh my God, someone's finally speaking out." It's the elephant in the room. Everybody knows that, you know, Sundance favors star vehicles, and will fill their slots with those first before looking. Everybody knows this, but no one talks about it because they don't want to be blackballed. I get a question a lot actually at our question and answers. Are you afraid that? Sundance is, you know, is there going to be some? Are you afraid of being blackballed from Sundance because of your movie? I'm like, well, I'm already blackballed from Sundance. What are they going to do? Keep me out of the festival? I'm already out of the festival. At least now they know my name and maybe they'll look at my work. So we thought, you know, if there isn't a doc like this, we should make one. And we decided it should be funny for two reasons. One is that, you know, as serious as it is, as heartbreaking as, you know, making your, you know, killing yourself to make your art and having it hit a glass ceiling, which has nothing to do with the quality of it. While that's very difficult, it's not, you know, apartheid. It's not curing AIDS. It's not, you know, Iraq. It's a voluntary art form, and it should be taken lightly. And the second reason is that it was a disaster. I mean, we were idiots. We messed up left and right, and so we thought it's got to be funny. I mean, basically, we're as open about our mistakes as anybody else's, and if you're going to go out there and it's going to be a train wreck, have a laugh.
Absolutely.
So I think of the film as a comedy road picture more than a documentary. I got to be honest.
That's fair enough. Do you think? I don't even remember where I was going to go with that. I've got so many questions right now.
Yeah, so do I.
Let's go through the story right now. It's not just Sundance that turned down 10 Till Noon. I mean, it was pretty much every single one.
Every major festival.
Yeah. And, and then you guys kind of struck gold with the smaller festivals.
Right, which is the thing that they don't really tell you. I mean, when you look at a festival, you say, what do I want out of a festival? Well, everybody thinks, well, I want to get rich. Didn't happen. Well, I want to, you know, sell my movie. I want to, you know, get distribution. I want to get some press. I want to be, you know, this, that, and the other. That's all great. But what do those things really mean? What does getting distribution mean? It means getting to your audience. What is, getting press mean? It means getting to your audience. All these things mean getting to your audience. If you screen at Sundance, and if you have the opportunity to screen at Sundance, screen at Sundance. My God, screen at Sundance. I mean, that's a great opportunity. But the audience will not be full of many regular folk. They'll be full of people from the industry, which is, of course, terrific. You know, distributors and press and agents and producers and other filmmakers and, you know, a few people who manage to squeak in from the public. But if you play at, say, the Phoenix Film Festival, you're playing to 99% real people who buy DVDs. So, okay, Sundance is one festival. There's about a bazillion other festivals. Every major market has several, and most markets have at least one. If you can get your film into enough markets, it's like having a small theatrical release for your movie, which theatrical releases for indie films don't really happen anymore. This is an incredible opportunity for people to find the good regional festivals that really do get an audience and that don't necessarily care that Brad Pitt's not in your film and screen there. And that's sort of what that's about. I mean, it's there's a lot of Denver Stars is a great example. Yeah, they've got a few star films, but they use them to anchor the independent movies.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what Phoenix does. They actually refer to them as bait films.
Okay.
Bait for press.
Nice.
Present company excluded because you're talking to me and I'm nobody.
The obvious question, what is it like being in a festival audience watching this movie? Do you get a mixture of applause and also the people going, shh, you're giving away our secrets? I mean, is it? What is it like to actually watch this with those who get it, who aren't part of the inside crowd?
I got to tell you, I was expecting mixed reactions. I don't make films to be popular. 10 Till Noon was a very divisive film. That was people either loved it or hated it. We had 50% walkouts at our Q&As, but the half that stayed were geeky about the movie. It's got a kind of a cult status. I wasn't sure how this film people would react to this film. Programmers at festivals have a decidedly mixed reaction to the movie. Either they love it or they're really offended by it. One major festival had their top programmer call me to tell me that he was rejecting the film. He was very nice about their call, but it was definitely like, let me tell you what offended me about your movie. Let me tell you what disturbed and annoyed me about your movie. Let me tell you how obnoxious your movie is.
Was it Indie Fest Chicago?
No, it was a major festival.
We'll get there.
Actually a major festival. Actually in the screenings, I mean, we have, I mean, knock on whatever wood that's available here. So far, and we're in our 19th festival now, we've had like, I mean, our screenings are ridiculously enthusiastic. We get, like, I mean, in the film we talk about this, at a Q&A, how many people leave during your Q&A, let you know how many people actually like the movie enough to ask you questions afterwards. We get, like, out of 200 people, 300 people, we get, like, one person leaving, or two. We get, like, we keep almost everybody. And the Q&As are really interesting because we make fun of Q&A questions in the movie.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
We don't get those questions. We get much more interesting questions. I tell them, don't be afraid to ask those questions we make fun of because you don't know the answers, but they don't. Yeah, and so we have like really like incredibly strong responses and incredible. I mean, again, knock on wood. It seems like when we get a good crowd, everybody there at the festival is in some way aware of festival life. They're either a filmmaker or a lot of them are regular people who just.
They're
enthusiasts, and they've been going to the festival for a couple years, so they're interested in this beast that comes around once a year. What does it do? And then they're really into it, which also lets me know the film is translatable to the average person. But the responses have been like really strong. I mean, really enthusiastic. Like, oh my God, this was hilarious, and this was great. Blah blah blah. And it's very strong. It plays better in a theater than on DVD. It's a comedy.
It absolutely is, absolutely. A question of curiosity, with what happened at Sundance this year, where one movie got bought. I mean,
right.
Does that kind of further cement your not even really wanting to even bother with the big one? Because if it's not going to pay off to go through all this work and killing yourself.
Well, the weird thing is, it's like, well, that all gets into the whole distribution question,
okay,
which
yeah,
is a whole
totally.
Other thing
oh,
right
yeah.
now. The studios basically bought indie film.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a whole distribution. They either bought all the major indie distributors and absorbed them into their companies, or they ran them out of business with the ones that they did buy. And what happened was, you know, the studios make things bigger and assume that everything will get bigger with it. You know, you make $1 million, $500,000 film and you buy it for $500,000 and then you put it in theaters and it makes $10 million. Hey, we made a tidy profit. Well, let's buy a $2 million film, put it in theaters. It makes $10 million. It's a tidy profit. Let's spend $10 million on a film now. It makes $10 million. I mean, specialty cinema, there's definitely an audience for it, but it's a fixed audience.
It's a niche, for sure.
It's a niche. And so you're not going to, with rare exception, like, you know, a Pulp Fiction or something like that where something really blows up, niche cinema is contained. So you know, people were buying these much larger, expanded $60 million indies financed by studios. Oddly enough, they don't make any money. Strange. And so the studios said, well, that's not good business. So they started shuttling the doors. So there's not a lot of buyers left. Basically, they bought all the buyers, drove half of them out of business, made the other buyers into large mini studios, which doesn't really work because they're halfway between the indie and studio world, and they're not strange bedfellows, shut their doors on those, and now there's no one left to distribute indie films. And the complaint is, well, the box office is down for indie films. Well, there's no indie films out there being distributed. That's the problem.
Yeah.
I know Gregory Garner, who's the main programmer for the Lemley Theater Chain in Southern California. He's like, we don't have any movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the films that we get are either major studio Indiewood movies, which are very few and far between, or we have filmmakers distributing their own films. We don't have, there's not a lot of, the Think Films of the world, the IFCs, are very few and far between right now.
Well, I mean, you had Artisan kind of start off like that, and then mm-hmm. they got bought out. It's like you said, everyone ends up, they had that grander scheme at some point, and then...
Right. The thing is that if someone, you know, the funny thing is that if someone had a lot of money and a lot of initiative, the indie film market is really where it was in the mid-80s, where there aren't a lot of indie films. If someone had $30 million and, like, a bit of brains, they could basically start it over again, go find the little gems, the little the Clerks and the Brothers McMullins that are out there, and find smart ways to market them. I mean, if you want to talk about smart marketing, let's look at the big indie film this year, which is Paranormal Activity. That's a true indie movie.
It's an indie movie, but the marketing, another story.
Okay, but this is a studio that went to, the guy couldn't get into a Sundance screening because it was sold out, went to a Slamdance screening of Paranormal Activity, which had good buzz in the horror film circuit. Went to Slamdance, saw this film, bought it. It's a no-budget movie. Paramount bought it strictly for the remake rights until somebody very high up saw it and said, you know what, this might be okay by itself. Let's try doing like a Midnight Blair Witch type thing with it. They did this very successful. This is it's put out by Paramount, but it's still an indie film.
Yeah.
And the lesson here is that if you take an indie film that's well made, and there are a lot of them out there, I promise you, most indie films are bad, but there are a lot of really good ones. You have to dig through the muck and find them, and you're not going to find them at Sundance. The guy couldn't get into Sundance. He went to Slamdance. He found it there. Interesting.
Yeah.
You know, you'll find them at the Phoenix Film Festival. You'll find them at the Dead Center Film Festival. These smaller, you'll find them at the Stars Film Festival, these smaller niche movies. You find a smart way to market it, you can make a lot of money. This is hand over fist money that Paramount Pictures is making. Not because they made some, you know, it's because they found this little niche movie and they did what everybody should be doing in just trying to promote indie films. Instead, they either sell them like widgets, or they try to make their own indie movies, or they buy big indie movies. The big one that cracked me up, this was, I think, the year before last at Sundance, I was reading this film called What Just Happened with Robert De Niro, right? This is an indie movie. Yeah. This is an indie movie directed by Barry Levinson, $20 million film starring Robert De Niro. It's an insider's look at producing movies. This is about as, like, uncommercial a film at $20 million as you can get. True, it's got De Niro in it. And it did not sell at Sundance. And this was like used as an example in Daily Variety as Sundance is no longer able to sell their indie films. I'm like, it's not Clerks. It's not the little gem. If you're there, if you're an acquisitions guy looking for the little indie gems, of course you're going to pass up this $20 million masturbation project. You know, give me a break. I mean, what are you talking about? That's not an indie film. And if it is one, it's not really what the Sundance is supposed to be built on.
Exactly.
And you got the waters being poisoned by the likes of the Spitfire Grill or Happy Texas, little movies bought for $10 million and didn't even make $1 million back. What, in your opinion, are some of the better, talking like the really good indie films, in addition to Tin Tin, of course.
Oh, of course.
Of course.
In Official Rejection, we can't forget that.
The Official Rejection, of course, yeah. What are some of the ones that you've seen that you really want people to notice?
One of the really best, one of the really good indie films, and this is like a truly like no-budget indie movie, it's still not distributed, it was never bought, it's called Johnny Montana.
Oh, yeah, it's in your
John
film.
John Gavin.
It's in your film.
That guy. Now, Johnny Gavin, and you'll see Official Rejection. Johnny Gavin's this crazy filmmaker. He's out there. He's like, Paulie, I got my film, man. I got to get my film. I can't. Oh, man, my film, my fucking film. Oh, I can't swear on the podcast.
It's okay. I can believe it. Yeah, we'll not, whatever.
So Johnny's this crazy manic guy. You've seen the movie. He's all over it. he's really like that. The first time I met him, he was like talking so loud we could hear him over the music at the club. And then he called me at 4 in the morning. I just met the guy. Woke me up. I was with my kids at the hotel in San Francisco. And he's like, Paulie, the police picked me up. They thought I was on drugs. I'm not on drugs. They tested my blood. I'm not on drugs. I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, what? This guy's movie's going to suck. But you know what? I tell you, I saw it. Not only is it like a surprisingly sober film. I mean, it's not a manic movie at all. It's a very well thought out movie. The guy's an extreme perfectionist. It's a really good movie. And it's been, when it's been programmed, it's been shown as an example of genuinely what you can do with indie film that's truly a no-budget movie, shot on video, completely guerrilla, no permits, in and around New York over a one-year period. It's full of terrific performances, and including John. It's really thoughtfully written, and it's a heartbreaking little love story movie. I mean, it's about this guy. He plays the lead. It's about this guy named John in New York, written and directed by a guy named John in New York. And he's trying to sort of, you know, growing up poor, and he's trying to better himself, get a better place in his life than his father was, his family was. And he ends up inadvertently becoming a gigolo. And he makes a lot of money as a gigolo, he lives his high life, but at the same time, he's going to keep that life separate from his regular life, where he's got this sweet little potential romance with this girl from the block that he's always liked. And, you know, it's sort of this dichotomy of his life. And it's a really, 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 really good film. And it's just not been seen. So that's one that I'd like to champion right now on this podcast.
By all means, absolutely. So. One thing that's very striking is the candor you get from the quote-unquote celebrities who you talk to, from, you know, Andy Dick to especially Kevin Smith. When he says, Clerks couldn't get made today.
Right.
It wouldn't get to Sundance today. It wouldn't make it. I don't think Aronofsky would probably get as far as he could as back then.
No, he wouldn't have.
Did you have to give them any kind of warning, hey, we're going to be just brutally honest, and they're like, cool, let's go for it?
We were upfront with our intentions about the movie. We're like, this is about, you know, what filmmakers really go through and how tough it is today. And I think the questions totally tipped them off. Kevin was
absolutely
great.
Yeah.
Kevin is literally one of, like, the nicest people I've ever met. Cool. And he's extremely hard to get in the schedule because he says yes to so many things. but he kind of goes, sure, man, I'm in. And he throws it over his shoulder, and his poor assistant tries to shove, get it all in there.
It's like you said, he's a media whore.
He's a bit of a media whore. I think he's a self-admitted media whore.
Exactly, he's actually, in the best way.
He's going to be here a week from...
Nope.
Isn't that canceled?
It got canceled.
Oh, why?
Some other appearance, or he's shooting something, or I think it was in a conflict with a couple of dicks.
Oh, he's got to go back to your research or something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
I follow him on Twitter. I didn't hear that. I emailed him. I said, hey, we're going to be in Denver at the same time. We'll take you to our Vada Villa Pizza, and, you know, and take you to Casa Bonita. No. I guess not. Anyway, he was extremely candid about the whole thing, and he's very self-effacing too. He's like, you know, hey man, I mean, if people like me can make a movie like this, anybody can make a movie like this, and that's kind of his attitude.
But even with Andy Dick and Tracy Lords, I mean, it was very refreshingly. I mean, they're not known for people to kiss anyone's ass, no matter what.
Well, they didn't, you know. Yeah,
but you know, they're not. I don't think they burned a bridge, but they weren't afraid to be very honest. And I really, really enjoyed that.
Well, good. I'm glad. I mean, that was the whole intention with the film, was to be as honest as possible and really kind of show things as they are. We definitely we didn't want anybody to soft soap anything. And I think the questions were... We were pretty, again, straightforward with our intentions.
Absolutely.
This is what we're trying to do.
Most definitely.
And they go, okay, yeah, okay, I get it. You know, it was never a situation of where we, you know, we'd try to go, what else do you say? And trying to dig deeper and trying to get into things. Andy was great. Andy was... if you see the film, it's like in front of this weird art.
Yeah.
That his friend, that he insisted on being shot in front of the weird naked art. It's very strange.
He was the first interview I ever did.
Some of the craziest,
really?
Craziest interviews we ever
had. I took a whiz while during the interview. He was like, can you guys hear that over the phone? Yeah.
He improvised a song.
Oh, my God.
Sang us a song about Jessica Simpson. It was great.
I know Nick Lachey is actually gay. Yeah, I mean, it was one of the most amazing, amazing interviews. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, he's great. I wish we used more of him in the film, but it was sort of like, he talked a lot about his film, Danny Rohn, first-time director, which he's talking about getting in fights in bars at South by Southwest. But when I couldn't get interviewed with Matt Dettler at South by Southwest, it was sort of like, well, I guess we're not much South by Southwest. Well, you know, we'll don't need to really cover that one as much. Fair. The thing is, we do cover Sundance as sort of the big example of the main big festivals. But in Sundance is the festival to which all other festivals seem to measure themselves, seem to define themselves. We're the next Sundance. We're another Sundance. We're the new Sundance. We're Sundance Wants to Be. We're the gay Sundance. We're the, you know, whatever it is. But South by Southwest, Tribeca, Toronto, Tiger, these are all, Los Angeles, these are all applicable to the same sorts of things that we're talking about with Sundance. We're talking about the top tier major festivals. They have big sponsors. They have this big business. There's, you know, a lot of egos involved, and there's a lot of agents involved and studios involved. And, you know, it's when Los Angeles Film Festival, when Film Independence, Los Angeles Film Festival, premieres a little independent movie called Transformers 2 Rise of the Fallen.
It's like Kung Fu Panda at Con.
That's right.
Yeah, well, Con is more like, we're a world cinema.
This is true, but still,
Independent. That's like the Ministry of Truth in 1984.
Yeah.
We're a film independent. we're gonna premiere this little film with this actor named Johnny Depp. Anybody heard of him? Called Public Enemies. This new filmmaker, Michael Mann. We're gonna premiere that at Film Independence, LA Film Festival. I've just, by the way, Film Independent also does the Spirit Awards. So I'm now never gonna get a Spirit Award from this interview.
I was gonna ask, have you had any kind of actual fallout? Like not even so much from doing the talking about naming names with these different festivals. We'll say with the swag. It's worth mentioning, like the Riverside Festival. Are you expecting another invite?
You know, I don't know. They're really nice. The Riverside people, I gotta say, I gotta reckon, are really nice. And we were kind of like making fun of the swag a little bit, but like, well, but
some people have a sense of humor and can roll with it.
Hopefully they can. I mean, the thing is that, you know, all the festivals are kind of guilty of, you know, except that unless you're a big one, unless you're also a star at a big one.
Yes.
They're all sort of guilty of, it's a bunch of stuff from the sponsors. The worst one, which if you get our DVD, which comes out Tuesday.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're getting there.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
The worst one was Temecula. Temecula's swag bag was literally filled with just a bunch of paper ads for restaurants at the strip mall where the theater was. And that was pretty much all it was. Like, look, it's a Chili's menu. Look, it's a menu for Domino's Pizza. Look, it's a menu for the Greek deli. What is this in this bag? And a dead flower. Yeah, that was in there.
That made it into the movie, right?
It did. We cut some of those other ones.
Okay.
You see the full Temecula experience on the DVD.
Okay.
We have the full Shrek work just from that one festival because it's so ridiculously silly.
Have you sent a screener of your film to these festival heads to be like, hey, look what we said about you in our movie?
No. But Bruce Fletcher, who's in the film also, he's the guy who is at San Francisco. He runs the Idaho International Film Festival also. That's actually, I think he doesn't work with San Francisco anymore. He's just exclusively Idaho. And which I think is a festival he founded. He said he wanted to see the film for program consideration. And I was like, well, you said in the film that you wouldn't program it. So I don't know. I don't know if there's the credit to the film.
Yeah.
He's like, well, I'll tell you what. I'll play it no matter what. I'm like, oh, well, look, if you really will consider playing it, I'll send it to you. But I don't want, if you don't like it, please don't ambush me there. But he loved it. And he actually made an official rejection mini festival within the festival.
Wow.
Official rejection, 10 till noon, and Johnny Montana
nice.
All played. And, it was, and in between was a seminar between the films. So you could come, talk for half an hour, show official rejection. Talk for half an hour, show 10 till noon. Dinner break, show Johnny Montana. And it was an amazing experience. But he was telling me the story when we were there. He was at Toronto, I guess, a few weeks earlier, as were most festival directors going up to Toronto. And he goes, yeah, guys, you know, I was up at Toronto and a bunch of, I'm paraphrasing, but I'm also impersonating while I paraphrase. but guys, I was up in Toronto and, yeah, I was sitting with a bunch of festival directors from all the big and little festivals at some bar, kind of an informal gathering. And your movie comes up in conversation and you're kind of infamous. You're kind of notorious. Like, really? Tell me more. I said, well, what festival? He's like, well, I can't tell you that because they've all seen it. I'm sure you didn't submit to all of them. So that to me means that they're copying your movie. I don't want to get anybody in trouble. So adding to the crimes of some film festival directors are illegally copying films that were not submitted to your festival. But apparently they'd all seen it. And I guess from his report, it was a split group. Half of them were like, yes, finally, this is the truth. This is, but you know, what we've been saying for years. And you know, Bruce, the kind of guy, Bruce is in charge of submission fee for Idaho. He flies you out there. He tries to give you two screens. I mean, he's really about, and he makes sure the films are watched all the way through. I mean, he's really one of those guys. He said that the half that thought we were obnoxious and were complaining about what we were saying, when they were asked why, it degenerated into them defending the actions in the film that we say that they do. No one's saying the stuff in the film isn't true. They're saying they wish we hadn't gone there.
Or okay, interesting.
The worst I've heard is we exaggerate. But, I mean, this a major film festival called to reject us.
Hmm.
And the guy was actually very nice. Like, you know, he liked the filmmaking, but he took issue with much of the content of the movie and the way we approached it. And he was very offended by a lot of it. And one thing that was a sticking point for him was programming. He's like, are you saying we programmers don't watch films all the way through? Okay, we don't. But can you blame us? So many, if a film is bad in the first half, my God, it's not going to get better. And I said, look,
wow.
I hear you. We talk about that in the movie. We address it in the movie. But it's not. I'm not.
If
not
it's true,
lying.
It's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Bruce Fletcher's point, to get back to him with that, is he's basically charging a submission fee is like basically penalizing someone for making a bad movie and making money off that. And it's also basically, if they're not watching the films all the way through, it's essentially stealing.
Absolutely.
Or it's a breach of contract. You're submitting a film for consideration. You're paying someone, say, $80. You're paying the festival $40 an hour to watch the film. And true, the volunteer doesn't get that money. That goes to the festival. The volunteer that's screening it is doing it for free. But you're still paying a service. Paying someone $80, if your film is 2 hours long, you're paying someone $40 an hour to sit on their butt, plop your DVD in, and watch a thing from start to finish. And if they're not doing it all the way, they are stealing from you.
Mm-hmm.
So the programmer side is totally valid. There's a lot of bad movies, man, and people will submit like they're, you know, their kid picking their nose for 2 hours. And they go, hey, submit to Sundance. And the Sundance programmer's going to sit down and go, I got to watch a kid picking his nose for 2 hours. But at the same time, the festival agreed to consider anything you submit for this amount of money. You know, you sit there and watch the kid pick his nose for 2 hours.
Or they could refund the money.
Or they could refund the money. Or they could stop charging.
Very true.
Interesting thing, submissions for Sundance were down. And it was the smaller, because people were getting into the idea that we can't get in. So they started this whole, like, you know, mumblecore section now. There's a ghetto for, like, no-budget movies. And they did it right around the time submissions were ending. And I started seeing ads for the first time ever. Submit your film to Sundance before it's too late. We are now considering little movies again or
as
something.
As long as you're within certain guidelines.
Yes. As long as you're... We're not going to call it mumblecore, but basically it's mumblecore because that's kind of fashionable. And submit it quickly. And it's all done in September. Well, first of all, I had it on good authority from an insider that most of the schedule is set by the end of July. Because all the films submitted by agents are being placed. So submitting early, you have an advantage because they like your film, it gets a slot. You submit later, they have to like your film more than something they're already in love with and boot the other thing out. It's harder. So the last couple of months of Sundance programming is largely cannon fodder. That makes them a lot of money because it's a lot of submissions, people trying to make the deadline. The fees go up to like $100+ for Sundance for this last month. So yeah, they suddenly added it to the section because submissions, I guess, were down. And are trying to boost the income.
Wow. Wow. Do you have any other questions before we get to the release?
Yes, one more question. Your film has a scene that I think is one of the most extraordinary of the year, and that's why I love this film, and I think it's one of the best films of the year, and I want to say, seriously, this is a film that's not only for film lovers and first-time filmmakers, this is a must-see film, and for no other reason, this sequence that you have late in the film, that I thought, this is amazing. It is at the Chicago Indie Film Fest. If you could describe not only the scene, but the tension and what it must have been like to be there.
Did you go through the same thing? That's
yes,
a better question.
Yes.
Well, our film screen later in the festival, and there were some issues with it, but you know, at that point they had the projection sorted down, so it only like sort of 20 minutes late or something. Chicago Indie Fest was an interesting festival. That was sort of our train wreck festival, and a filmmaker named Blaine Weaver, whose film Outside Sales, very good film by the way, very low budget, wonderful romantic office comedy, kind of like The Office meets, I don't know, a good romantic comedy. His film was, that film was one of the opening night movies. And I don't want to say what happens.
That's
but
true.
It's a complete train wreck. I mean, it really has to be seen to be believed what he goes through. And I kind of, like, it was very expensive to go to Chicago. As we say in the film, we were given very late notification about everything. So it was like an arm and a leg to get our cameras to Chicago. Even though, in a normal situation, as a filmmaker, I would skip that so late in the game. It's a small festival. It's clearly not run well. What's the point? It was lining up to be a complete disaster. I mean, from the get-go. Those interviews we're talking about before the festival, those were conducted before the festival. We knew it was going to be a wreck. It was much worse than we thought it would be, which is terrible for them, great for our cameras, of course.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't have gone there if I hadn't had the inkling it was going to be what it was, if I wasn't shooting this movie. It's a lot of tension. I had a filmmaker one time rush out of the theater. I didn't know it was some guy rush out of the theater. I thought, well, maybe I offended him. It was one of our first screenings, and later I ran into him at a party. He was a filmmaker, and he said, actually, I could not watch it. It was hurting my chest.
Oh, yeah.
I could not watch the sequence. It hurt me. I came back in after I heard it was over. I just couldn't put my. I couldn't. It was just so painful.
That's like a chance in a lifetime catching that though.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
It was
an awful version of it, but yeah.
Yeah, it was good. Again, good for the movie. And thing is, you know, I didn't know Blaine that well. He's become one of my best friends since then. Like, you go through the trenches together, you build brotherhoods.
Absolutely.
As Blaine will say. But at the time, I only met him at one other festival, which is how I knew he was at Indie Fest. I was like, can I cover you going through your process? I didn't know him that well, and I'd never seen him angry. He's a really even-keeled guy. And I didn't know what he was going to do. So, like, I just rolled. The only thing I stopped for was to change the battery of the tape. I rolled for, like, 2 solid hours on that disaster, or 2.5, whatever it was. 2.5 hours of straight pain. And I just rolled, and he'd walk up to me, and I didn't use any of this in the movie, obviously. He'd walk up to me, and he'd look right at the camera, like, for an inch away. And he'd be like, thanks, camera. You getting good stuff? It's good. And I'm like, does he mean he's happy I'm getting this so it won't go away unrevenged and unseen and it will live on and people will know about this? Or is he just going to beat me with the camera because he thinks I'm exploiting him and watching his pain? I think it was a little of both, actually. But he didn't beat me. And after it was over, he was like, do I look like a jerk? And I said, no. You did not.
No,
you did
dude. Not. Patience like, of Job. Are
patience,
you kidding me?
Exactly. So I cut it. It was the first sequence that I cut. And I cut that sequence and I showed it to him and he goes, yeah, okay, I think so. But he wasn't convinced. We brought in his actors from outside sales. We recorded their audio commentary for their DVD in my office. So okay. I brought him in and he's like, I showed them the sequence and they're like, my God, Blaine, how did you not kill this woman? There was a guy who saw the film and he commented, I think it's on Facebook, he wrote, I can't believe Blaine didn't kill the volunteer at Chicago Indie Fest. And I'm really glad he didn't because I want to.
Totally, totally. That's absolutely the case. So we're getting close to distribution for you, and you're essentially self-distributing. Kind of, sort of.
Sort of. The way it's working is there are several companies that are not distributors that are sponsoring the distribution.
Okay.
For their own, each one for their own different reasons. And what that does is it creates basically a situation where we're not really funding our distribution, but we're controlling it.
Very interesting.
If that makes any sense.
So you still got control of the property of Official Rejection throughout this whole process.
We own the rights to everything. The way that it's working is that like one of the companies is Amazon, and they're providing they're like, we want you to use our fulfillment engine because we want something, we want to show it work on a larger scale, and so we will Without a Box is very much behind this. Like, we'll give you this, that, you know, like, okay. There's a couple other companies that are just like, we're going to put, you know, we're going to give you advertising, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. It's like, okay, so basically, you know, in terms of DVD distribution, I mean, the theatrical on this movie has pretty much been screening societies. It's opening in Tallahassee this weekend as a part of at an indie film theater. It's been a few of those and a lot of festivals. And that's kind of what because it's, although I think, as you said, I feel also it can play to anyone, it's also a question of whether the distributor is going to take a chance on something that seems as niche as it is to try to get it to a broad audience. Theatrically, it doesn't make a lot of sense other than these niche places it plays where we've been getting very good response. For DVD, it makes sense to do it this way where it's really just getting it onto internet, you know, Amazon, Netflix, iTunes. That's where indie film really lives. You don't get on a lot of shelves when Fast and the Furious, when it streams on DVD, comes out with 8 editions. DVD full screen, DVD full screen 2-disc, DVD widescreen, Blu-ray, Blu-ray 2-disc, Blu-ray 3-disc.
Don't forget the unrated cuts.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of shelf space left for indie films anymore. You don't find them at Best Buy very much. You tend to find the big movies. So indie films, if you get a regular distributor, you're still going to end up on Amazon, Netflix, all the same places, and they'll do $30,000 in advertising for you, and that's basically about it. If you do it your way, you can get on the same venues without really putting any money out there, and these companies are basically providing all the services that a distributor would provide, but they don't take any money.
Interesting.
Except Amazon takes a store fee. We're on Amazon exclusively for 3 months, but then they're releasing the purse strings and wherever you want to go. So it's sort of a new model, because the thing is, as we talked about before, indie distribution is sort of up in the air right now, and the only rule anymore is the old rules don't really work.
Totally, so absolutely.
Once the DVD's out, then we're going to start talking about television sales, and we have a sales rep for that, and he's going to shop us around. The DVD does well, we can get a lot of TV sales. If it doesn't do well, it doesn't hurt the TV sales.
Okay.
So that's sort of the way that's kind of working, if that makes any sense. Foreign we haven't approached yet.
Okay.
There's been a few nibbles, but we'll see. The idea would be ideally to sell off to a foreign sales company that would basically take it and do the worldwide with it.
Okay.
But we'll see. I'm not sure how it's going to translate out of the English language, being a comedy.
Yeah. And it is a very unique situation, too, that you guys are going through. But it's going to be a one disc and a two disc.
Yes.
Which is important to say. Is it going to be like on Amazon Unbox, like doing the video streaming?
Yes. I don't know when, but I'm hoping it'll be on this week on Amazon. I don't know how long it takes, but now it's called Amazon On Demand.
Okay.
But you can buy or rent it on Amazon On Demand. That was very important. I wanted people to be able to rent the movie because the Amazon window is only 3 months. It means you can't Netflix it for 3 months. It means you can't, do these other things. But as far as Unbox or Amazon Demand goes, for how much, $2, $3, but you could rent it.
Which also helps with the whole piracy thing, too.
Correct. But it's also why we have the single disc. We wanted a kind of a stripped-down, cheap edition so that people could buy it, and if they didn't want to spend a lot of money, they hadn't seen it before, but they wanted to check it out, they wouldn't have to spend a lot to get it. But for the fans, we wanted the two-disc. And two-disc has a lot of my favorite stuff on it. It's got... it's actually my favorite scene in the movie was cut.
Oh.
And it's on the two-disc. It's a sequence where we're stuck in the George Bush Airport in Houston. And we're stuck in this airport for, our plane's delayed. We're on our way to Toronto for this little festival. And we're just trapped there. And Scott was like, dude, break out the camera. Because this happens. This is travel hell is part
Absolutely.
Of the festival experience. And so we have this two-minute, basically, music montage of us tormented for hours as our departure time is going later and later and later and later, and the airport's being rude to us. And we want to promote the film. We're not up to Toronto to promote the film, so we can go over the internet. Well, there's no Wi-Fi. So then we find out that, at the President's Club, there's for the elite, there's Wi-Fi. So we smoosh ourselves in this little groove between the luggage carts and the wall to steal their Wi-Fi. So we can go on MySpace and send blasts. And then Continental Airlines are being complete bastards to us, and we catch all that. And then the best is when they shove us all onto the plane like cattle at the end in a mass hurry. They're sparing all pretense of politeness whatsoever.
Nice.
This is my favorite part of the movie. It's really pretty hilarious. We also have a bit with the Toxic Avenger.
Really? Okay, I was going to say, we didn't even get to talk about Lloyd Kaufman.
Lloyd Kaufman is amazing.
Yes.
He is amazing. We have a whole webisode with Lloyd seeing the film for the first time on our website.
Okay.
If you haven't seen it, Mr. Kaufman Comes to Dead Center.
All right, called. Sweet.
But Lloyd's great. But we did a whole thing on the DVD on the second disc on Troma Dance, and that you didn't see. Basically, the Toxic Avenger, some stuff he does. He goes to a gifting suite. It's interesting. Gets a little Botox and Restylane.
Very nice.
It's good. Looks like Jennifer Aniston afterwards. It's good.
Very beautiful. Beautiful. Okay, so the movie is Official Rejection. It comes out this Tuesday on Amazon, 3 months later, everywhere else you could possibly want to buy it, pretty much.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for joining us, sir. This is a bit longer than we were planning, but this has been so fun.
I hope it's been good. I tend to ramble, and I'm tired from my flight to LA, so I hope it's okay.
Absolutely.
I want you to get to your red carpet, so.
Yeah.
What time is it right now?
It's just about 1:45, so.
Oh, okay.
A little bit of time.
Good. Excellent.
Great. So, thank you, guys. That was a real pleasure.
Yes.
I really appreciated being on.